Hello, nurse leaders. We all know the benefits of clinical simulations where we set up lifelike scenarios and often use high-fidelity mannequins to help nurses build the confidence and focus on honing their clinical skills. But what about situations involving high stress, high stakes communication, and team dynamics? Our guest today talks about developing effective communication skills using improvisational exercises and principles to help improve collaboration and patient safety. Keep on listening. Welcome to the Insightful Nurse Leader. This is a podcast by nurse leaders for nurse leaders. This show is focused on assisting leaders become effective managers and change facilitators. I'm your host, Miles Perilla. Join me every week as I speak with fellow nurse leaders, share insights, lessons learned, and practical advice. So, whether you're a seasoned frontline leader, a budding charge nurse, an experienced manager, or executive, you don't want to miss this. Welcome to our seventh episode of the Insightful Nurse Leader. Our guest today is an international speaker, an award-winning actor, author, filmmaker, portrait artist, and a nurse. As a professional actor, she has appeared on stage, screen, radio, and TV. She co-founded an improv and stand-up comedy group in the San Francisco area in the 90s and has facilitated improv training to teams of all sorts in three countries since then. Because she's an improv actor, I have no idea what she's going to say. Please welcome Dr. Kenny Campbell.
Oh, thank you, Miles.
Well, thank you so much for joining me in the show. Our topic today is all about improv in nursing. So can you start with sharing with us, what is improv and how can this help our nursing workforce develop skills on team building and communication?
Improv is to acting what being a tightrope walker without a net is to the circus. And you might be familiar with the television show. I think most everybody's seen it. Whose Line Is It Anyway? And when people approach them and say, I'm working with teams and we're using applied improvisational exercises, they suddenly often get that deer in the headlights look. Like, oh my gosh, no, you're not going to get me up there doing some role playing this or that. And I have to say that that's not what it is. Anybody who's been to the taping of one of those television shows knows that the production team is under the thumb of the sponsors. And so therefore, they cut out anything that is not what they consider a laugh of enough decibels or enough length to actually make it into the TV show. So no, we're not doing that. What I like to say is it's also more like if you're a dancer or a musician. If you're a dancer, let's say you're a ballet dancer, you go to the gym, you work out on the bar, etc. If you're a musician, you do practice without actually doing your performance. It's part of the flexing, the keeping limber, the learning how to let go and be sort of in the flow. Now, the way it translates into healthcare happened by accident for me, because like you mentioned, my first gig, if you will, my first degree is in acting. I came to healthcare and nursing specifically after I'd already been a professional actor and with a lot of experience. But if you know anything about that particular industry, it's kind of hard to get successful without, let's say, taking off your clothes. And I knew after one experience with a director who tried to put the moves on me that that was not what I was interested in doing. I threw the baby out with the bathwater. I quit acting for over a decade. and just tried to find another path. And as it happened, I got what they call the call to be a nurse. And that was important for me for a number of reasons that didn't have anything to do with acting. I always felt as an actor that I chose the scripts carefully of what I performed in. I always wanted to bring joy to an audience, or at least give them something to think about in an authentic way, even though I was playing another person. There's a lot of good outcomes, I think, that you can inspire as an artist, right? Well, then when I became a nurse, having already been in the corporate world, and I will tell you that the job I took after experience in the real world, after I graduated with my degree in theater and acting, I was a flight attendant with Pan Am in the day. And because I already had an acting and speaking background, they tapped me to be on their PR team. And so I would go around and represent Pan American in whether it was a convention, or I would speak to sponsors, possible sponsors, schools, whatever. I half-time did my work as a flight attendant, and then other time they would send me here and there. In fact, my first international commercial we shot in Rome because they knew I did what I did. Well, all that to say that when I was a part of a flight crew, it was in the military model. The jobs were very siloed. We each had a specific list of tasks that we were responsible for doing. But similar to healthcare, we didn't always know each other. We would form, storm, norm, and perform just like we do in healthcare on the fly. We'd have an hour. Actually, we had, in healthcare, you don't always have a full hour. We would have an hour or more to prep before we took off. And then, mind you, we never took off without a full crew. How often in healthcare do you have to go into your shift and you don't have enough people, right?
Well, so far recently, almost every day.
Yeah, it's sad but true. And so when I approached healthcare, I already had this idea of what I expected it was going to be like. And then, lo and behold, it was not what I expected in two counts. First of all, I saw it was, now again, I was licensed in 1979 and I worked as a CNA before then, but still in the day, I saw doctors throw a chart at nurse. One time a doctor threw a pencil at me to get my attention. Can you imagine? And this was in the day when, before computer charting, there were only so much desk space and so many chairs. And it was understood that if a doctor came in and needed a chart, they just cleared their throat and all the nurses would look up and somebody would have to give them your seat. Well, and then there were other people who, and this was, I imagine, my personal bias. And that was that people that I saw who were seasoned nurses, who, in my humble opinion, had never had an opportunity like I had had to face-to-face in a service organization other than nursing. They went straight from high school into nursing, and they never knew what I would call phone etiquette. They didn't know how to build a relationship with someone because it was all transactional. It wasn't relational. So that was something that was sort of brewing in the back of me as soon as I got into nursing. And again, I did not even start improv right when I was in school because I'm that old. It wasn't like a thing for a while. And what happened was I went through a divorce and moved to the San Francisco area. Right away, I decided two things. First of all, I wanted to get back into acting because my husband didn't want me to do that. So I hadn't done it for a long time. But I got a commercial acting agent right away and started, even though I was working full-time in women's health, labor and delivery, and NICU, I got acting gigs. And after about a few months of going through a divorce, I know there are a lot of people out there who know what it's like. It's even in so-called good ones, it's, you know, amicable. Well, mine was not. It was difficult, very difficult. And after a few months, I just said to myself, I just want to laugh. I just want to get my sense of humor back. I just want to laugh. And so I signed up to take some stand-up comedy classes. And what I learned there was that, first of all, I felt very uncomfortable because I didn't have the mask of a character to hide behind. I was creating humor about my own life, which was pretty sad at the time. And what I learned was that everybody else in this class of like 8 people, they all were taking improv. And they were fluid. They were spontaneous. They were able to deal with whatever came up at the next instant. And I was a bit stiff. So of course, I started taking improv. And within about a year, 4 of us split off from that group and co-founded our own improv company. So there you have, that's the beginning. And right away, I learned that this was a really good way to learn how to spontaneously solve problems and be creative. But I didn't at that time see the relevance for healthcare. Well, wouldn't you know? One night, a fella came down front after a show, and like other people, he was asking those questions of, oh, you must have had a script, you must have had a template, you know, you did this and that, and it was so funny. We really liked it. And we convinced him, no, you know, none of that is true. It's improv. Some of our best work is in rehearsal. You'll never see it, you know. And he said, okay, well, if that is true, then I have another question. He said, what I saw you do when such and such a thing happened and this was said and that was said, you all had an instant problem to solve and you came up with some spontaneously creative solutions. Could you come talk to my engineers? And that was in 1995, Miles. And so as it turned out, I was the only one of the 4 of us who had done curriculum development. I had a minor in education. And that was the first time there in Silicon Valley, I started teaching improv as a team sport to business. And these were startups. And that's when it clicked. Holy moly, we should be doing this in healthcare.
That is amazing. I appreciate you for sharing your journey, particularly how you were able to find the problem in the opportunity to be able to integrate that in nursing or the workforce in general. And what you mentioned about the mask when playing a character resonates with me because in a way, there is a tendency to wear a mask to fit in an organizational culture or a department. But the downside to that is we're not really being our authentic self. Mm-hmm. And you've pointed out the value of being an authentic self. So with that, how is this relevant with retaining our workforce?
Oh, ever so much. And I will tell you that the basis of the work that I do is identifying the problem as miscommunication. And in so doing, I was just last month in Atlanta for the American Nurses Association conference and gave a session there, a keynote there. And so I was preparing for this. And one of the things that came up in the research was a study that Press Ganey did just last September. And it was, I can't remember exactly what the title of it was, but it had something to do with why millennial nurses are disgruntled, leaving, or burned out, or something like that. And it was a large study, and the object was to look at various reasons that people are disgruntled, if they're leaving their workplace, or if they're thinking of leaving the profession altogether. And of course, they delved into this with a study of DEI. Now, diversity and equity, we can understand, especially if you happen to be a minority, these are very important. But this was a bigger study that had people of all stripes. It wasn't just a minority audience. So therefore, the most interesting part of the study was that across the board, the biggest problem that they found as nurses, millennial nurses in healthcare, was inclusion. And so the way they broke it down was a sense of belonging. So Miles, when you ask yourself, what does it mean to be your authentic self? It means that you have a sense of belonging so that you don't, it's a safe place so that you don't have to put on that nurse face all the time and be transactional. You can be relational. And I think that that's the beauty of improv, is that just like if you read Daniel Goldman's work about emotional intelligence, his work builds on a lot of other work that's come up through the years on cognitive behavioral knowledge. And so I reflect back to the beginnings of Piaget. And remember, he focused in on young people, 5 years and less. And his study was a launching pad for Bloom and his taxonomy and the people who carried on after that. And what we learn is that, of course, children are more kinesthetic, right? And that the best way to learn is to be active, which brings us to the beauty of simulation.
Correct.
And that also Bloom took it a step further and said, this is how human beings learn. And if you remember, at the top of the pyramid is creativity, and right under that is evaluation. And under that is it's analysis and evaluation, right? And then creativity is on top. And I think in healthcare, we get stuck in the analysis and the evaluation part.
Agree.
Right? There's so many policies and procedures, lest we hurt someone or kill someone, God help us. But in improv, again, it allows us a safe space to come together for everybody to, lest, dare I even use the word, make mistakes and fail in a safe environment, because in improv, nobody's going to get hurt. And to your question about what's the difference between simulation, we're not role-playing in healthcare scenarios at all when I teach this. Never. No, because then it's not safe. Then maybe somebody's thinking of a situation, getting pulled into a memory, or forecasting something. No. We want to just get away from healthcare, just like the athlete might go into the gym and do push-ups or whatever. And that's not, you know, he's a runner and he's not doing that. It's not the same thing. It's giving your brain a rest, but practicing the abilities, the skills that allow us the agency to do what we do.
So how does that typically work when you're conducting an exercise? Do you start with a specific topic, or do you cue them in a specific situation? How does that work?
Okay. Well, it depends upon who I've got. So very often in healthcare, like in my book, the latest book is Improv to Improve Healthcare. And because I did my doctoral work on this topic, I know that when I was teaching improv to business or business people or older people or younger people, I've taught it to all ages and stages, I didn't need to go through the neuroscience. But with healthcare people, it's often helpful to, well, I don't usually start with it. I usually start with an exercise, a get to know you exercise, just to sort of disarm people and help them understand that we're here for fun, because play is the way we learn the quickest and the best. And so usually I'll start out with icebreaker exercises that are get to know you. And there are many of them that I use depending upon the groups. And so after we do that and we sort of limber up and we do a little bit of a debriefing about what did that bring up for you? How did that feel? How might that be useful in your personal or your professional life? You know, then usually is when I start introducing the principles that improv actors work with. I call it the actor's toolbox. And those are things that Goldman tells us to do, but not how to do. Like listen. How do you listen? Well, we've got exercises for that. And again, they allow people to come together, whether it's with a partner or three people or a smaller group or what have you. I keep changing it up so that even if you're dealing with people either that you know or that you don't know, it will be a learning experience. And at the end, again, not healthcare related, what happens is during the debriefing, people are amazed that number one, they never thought of themselves. So many people say, I have never thought of myself as a person who's like a comedian or humorous, really. You know, I'm pretty left brain, pretty serious, but I have never laughed so hard. You know, and because everything is spontaneous, you know, it's not planned. And so therefore, it's very freeing. And then we go on to do other exercises that stimulate. Once you have a safe space, you can stimulate creativity, spontaneous creativity. It really has to do with the relationship that you begin with.
So from a simulation standpoint, it's really about learning by actually doing it. So do you facilitate a debrief after every event?
Well, yes. And I'm really glad that you mentioned more about simulation. I taught that for over 10 years and even ran a simulation at the first university where I taught. I always use improv with my students. And we didn't wait until the end of the scene to do the debriefing. We did in-sim debriefing. It's not my idea. I got it from somebody else. I can't remember where I got it. Was at some NLN conference. I heard about it. And come to find out, when I brought the idea back, I was at the University of San Francisco at the time, finding out that two other simulation professors who were also in the faculty, they were also using a version of it. So just to give you an example, every group that I had that was new, they were new to me, and sometimes they knew each other a little or not at all. We always did an icebreaker because, again, the principle is that if you don't have a safe space, then all you're thinking about is your own performance. And maybe you're thinking in simulation, especially if you're non-licensed, you're pre-licensed, of course, you're worried about putting in a catheter with a sterile garb and your sterile procedure. You're worried so much about that that you forget that you're dealing with either a mannequin or, if we have a standardized patient, a person who's playing a patient. You forget about, in my opinion, the most important part of nursing is the relationship that you have with that patient and or anybody else who's in the room.
Or your coworkers.
Exactly. So that is why improv is such a great way. And what we would do, I would give permission to students to say, look, if you have a question about, you know, here's a path I could go either way, then just ask for a timeout. Let's just stop, talk about it, and then we'll rewind a little bit, take it from when you said this and or when you did that or what have you. And then every single time you finish the scene, you are successful. There's none of this, oh, well, we'll show you what you did wrong in the debriefing. No. And then I would give myself permission, and I told them that too. All right, sometimes I will stop it if, you know, it's going down a really wrong path, or there are some better choices that you probably maybe don't know. And I would say things like, okay, this is a point of information. Just want to cue you into this. And, you know, sometimes that happens in the university when students are brought into simulation when they haven't actually had the didactic yet. You tell them, read this chapter, but they haven't seen it, or they haven't had the lecture about it. And
Yeah, there's no baseline knowledge.
No.
Yeah, especially if it's their first time.
Yeah.
Or newer nurses.
Exactly. So I would stop for a point of information or a question so that I could ask them those questions that, and sometimes it was just, I recognized that they were too afraid to ask me. So I'd say, you have an interesting look on your face. What is going through your mind right now? How are you making this decision? See, that's in-sim debriefing. It is so helpful.
Yeah, certainly applicable, and especially in high stress situations. Well, coming from my background in emergency nursing, you can only plan so much, but anything can walk through those doors. And, you know, you just got to be ready and be able to respond right away. So you mentioned about during the mini debrief sessions and such, have you encountered situations where participants in the simulation or the improv exercises where individuals had situations triggered a sense of traumatic event? And how did you handle that?
You know, that's an interesting question. In improv classes outside of the simulation environment, no, because I have control over setting it up. But what I found in the simulation environment was that if we have pre-licensed people who have, as you call them, triggers that I don't know about, and as a faculty, I'm hoping, assuming that everybody has done their homework. And usually, you know, in a simulation environment, I would never just say, okay, I know you did this homework or this was your assignment, so we'll just launch into the scenes, because that creates a lot of meltdowns. And I know, because I was teaching other simulation instructors how to be successful, that's a recipe for disaster, really, because you shouldn't assume that how one person prepared was enough, or that they even did it, actually. So we would go through with the students, and I would try and answer or ferret out of them every possible question that they had, whether it was about the labs or the psychosocial or anything that we could come up with about the case, so that everybody, all the questions that they could think of were answered before they went in. And the students who were in the next room watching on closed circuit TV really thought that what they were seeing was so insightful. But one day I had what I did not know was a student who was, shall I say, psychologically brittle. I didn't know, I'd never met her, but her cohort of people knew that she was a piece of work, is all I'm going to tell you. But she presented just like everybody else. She answered the questions and all of that. But when we got into the sim and it was her opportunity, and again, it was random, you know, we picked persons to be in the sim randomly, she was to sterilely insert a catheter. And she had been checked off on it, supposedly, but for whatever reason, she had a meltdown, a total meltdown. She was a senior. 3 weeks from graduation was not a good scene. So we definitely had to stop and debrief and walk her through it and everything. But that was the most difficult.
Thank you for sharing that. Because even, you know, now in real life nursing practice, you see a lot of that. And you have a lot of nurses having moral injury with their experiences, and whether it's conscious or unconscious, that they snap out and have their own meltdown at work. And the big part of it is self-awareness and being able to know how to handle these situations for themselves and for their coworkers, to be able to identify what best to support them in that it doesn't affect patient safety.
Indeed. And I think at the basis of that problem, unfortunately, in nursing school or within the profession, is this perfectionist tendency. We're so afraid we're going to hurt somebody that we think we have to be perfect, or that we can't ask for help. Or perhaps in that student's case, she didn't really practice very much.
So in these situations or exercises, how do you generate or encourage or cultivate individual accountability versus team accountability as far as the improv goes? Or is this more focused on the individual?
Because we are away from any of the triggers for healthcare, the beauty of improv is that we get both individual and team exercises. And so therefore, as one student said, even though I was in the audience when you were doing a demo with three other people who were on stage, I learned from that, which is similar to the simulation when you're in closed circuit TV. You still learn because you see it. And she said, it's like you can't unring a bell. When this has been presented to you and you feel safe in this environment to approach people who, and I love to work with people who don't know each other. It's the best because they know there's no setup. They don't know these people. And yet at the end of the work, they feel they've made like great friends and they really do know people because of the way we set it up. It's such an inclusive environment. And because they get to be their authentic and vulnerable selves, even though much of the time when we're doing scene work, they're pretending they're somebody else.
That's very insightful. So, Candy, what about being able to conduct these exercises not in an in-person setting?
Let me preface this by saying that was the question that started, of course, as soon as COVID came. And I pushed back very hard on this because I just couldn't see how you could have the same quality of teaching and learning in what we have right here in this online environment. However, friends of mine in the improv community who have carried on and done virtual simulations, and I've been a part of a few, have shown me that you can do a lot of work in the virtual environment, that at least carving out some work, some progress is better than none. And I don't think anything will take the place of in person. And I do train the trainers, but to get a basic experience, we definitely could do that. And I do it even on my one-to-one coaching.
That is very nice. Thank you for sharing that. The follow-up question regarding conducting these exercises. So with different organizations or even different industries, do you have a set of measure of success in terms of relating this to, say, being contracted for an organization to conduct improv for their teams? Do you have a set of measure of success that translate to operations and such?
The best measure of success is assessments, and that's one. Those are qualitative assessments, but the other one is the retention rate.
Well, thank you for sharing your story and, you know, how this really is valuable to the nursing workforce, especially during these times. I mean, I can see the true value of this myself. Well, Candy, can you share lessons that you've learned in your journey in being a nurse, a nurse leader, and conducting improvisation to our fellow nurse leaders?
You know, one of the problems that I see that you and I were discussing previously, Miles, is that within nursing, healthcare in general, there's often not a great succession plan. And I know you and I both know instances where a person was elevated to, let's just say, the first rung, clinical coordinator, because they're a good clinician or because they raised their hand at a certain time when somebody asked, or because they were a friend of the director, or who knows what. Now, in magnet hospitals, they actually have committees and interviews, but a lot of places are not magnet. But even within the magnet hospitals, sometimes you see that the people who, even after the evaluations and the interviews, it's not as though the groundswell gets to vote. It's certainly still left up to the directors to decide who becomes a part of the leadership team. And sadly, I think what happens is someone will be appointed, or will say, you know, you get the post. And one of two things. Well, generally, the first thing that happens is, great, you're now in this post. Now you'll get leadership training, as opposed to prefacing leadership with training, which I think is the prudent way, you know? The second thing that happens sometimes is that if there is some sort of agenda within the C-suite, the person who gets the job, who gets the leadership title, is a person who is not known for speaking out. It's a blank canvas person who has not shown any leadership qualities, but there they go. And so they're not looked to as a leader. And of course, you know that first rung and middle management are very difficult positions, and they have to sort of straddle, you know, between the people that they're working with and the team, and then the administration that gives them the dictums to help create. And I've been in these positions myself, and I know that if you don't show yourself to be a leader that is respected by everyone, maybe starts with plain old just being kind, that you won't be able to make relationships with the people who may not like you because you are in leadership, especially in certain positions, certain organizations, I should say. So the improv training really helps show how to create instant, almost very quick relationships with people so that you can communicate. And so that if you're the person who is at the bedside, let's say, you know that that person will hear you. Here's one last thing I want to say about that. In the past, and I think this is changing happily, but in the past, I know that I was told, and other people have been told, that once you get into a management leadership position, you cannot be friends with the same people that you were friends with before. Well, definitely your relationship is going to change. And of course, you know, you have more responsibilities, different responsibilities, but disavowing a relationship, the responsibility of a person in a leadership position, in my opinion, is to be a coach, not to be an authoritarian figure. And as a coach, you can remain friends with people as long as you know and they know that not to take advantage of that friendship. And there's ways of showing that without having to be crude about it. Like, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you. We can't be friends before, which I have heard people say.
To me, it sounds like setting clear professional boundaries.
That's the word.
Certainly. Well, that's very insightful. It's funny because we get so focused on retaining our frontline nurses, but to your point, it's equally of value on focusing on retaining our leaders, especially our middle managers, who we see a lot more turnover because of whether the workload or the office politics or perhaps changing priorities in life or their personal life or professional careers. So it's really important to be able to tune in and focus as well and give support to the nurse leaders who are leading the frontline team. So yeah, thank you so much for this time. And this is very insightful again. And one last thing, how can our listeners connect with you?
Yes, well, a couple of ways. I have two websites. My educational website is candycampbell.com, and they can email me at candy@candycampbell.com. Or if they're interested in Florence Nightingale, the acting part of my life is my third solo show is an evening with Florence Nightingale, and they can see video clips on the website florencenightingalelive.com.
That is awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for your time, and I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, Miles. A pleasure.
Thank you for listening. To view the complete show notes and all the links mentioned in today's episode, visit milesperillaconsulting.com/podcast. And before you go, make sure you follow or subscribe to this podcast so you can receive the latest episodes as soon as they're released. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in Apple Podcast. Thank you again for joining me. This is your host, Miles Perilla, and you're listening to The Insightful Nurse Leader. I'll see you next time.